Opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
And good morning and welcome to this January 9th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can subscribe. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. So happy to be doing what we always do this month. I can't believe it. This month I'm celebrating 12 years of doing the show, and the show is edging in on 21 years of broadcast, which means there are a lot of interviews up on the web for all of you to hear. So nothing is better than interviewing incredible authors with incredible books, but also people who are friends. So I get to do that right now. Debut novelist Jen Stroud Rossman is joining me now, and in the second half hour, I'll chat with grammar columnist and guru June Casagrande about her latest, The Joy of Syntax. Jen Stroud Rossman writes the essay series An Engineer Reads a Novel for Public Books. Her stories have appeared in Hobart, Literary Orphans, Jellyfish Review, on and on. Her work has been a finalist for honors including the BOA Editions Short Fiction Prize, the Disquiet Literary Prize, and more. She has earned her BS and PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. She's a professor of mechanical engineering at Lafayette College. Her book, The Place You're Supposed to Laugh, is published by 713 Books. We're going to chat about that. Writing, process, craft, all of it. Jen, welcome. So, we've had a lot of lawyers and psychologists and some doctors dabbling in fiction on the show. I'm not sure entirely if we've ever had an engineer. So before we dive into the book, and because I don't know this from our own friendship, I was hoping you just talk for a moment about kind of the engineering novelist thing and kind of maybe the synergies between the two and just kind of how the heck you came to these two sort of disparate career paths.
That's a really interesting question, and I'm hoping you can still hear me. Just let me know if the board goes wonky.
Nope, you're all good.
So I certainly for a long time thought of them as pretty separate pursuits. I thought that there was part of me that always really liked playing with Legos and building things and imagining, you know, sort of creating worlds. And then there was this other part of me that loved reading stories and then writing them and, well, I guess, creating worlds, right? And so they're kind of similar. They're both creative, and they're both, I think, really fundamentally about storytelling. And I think both only work well if they start with a sense of empathy. So if you're going to design, you know, a gadget or an app or whatever, you have to be thinking about how does this actually meet a human need and how might this interact with existing sort of human culture and society and stuff like that. And you have to do all that, too, when you sort of dream up imaginary people and set them around billiard-balling off each other.
Yeah, right.
But it took me a really long time to figure out that they were that there was anything similar about the way my brain worked in both of those things. And so I pursued sort of the math and science gauntlet that leads you to an engineering degree, thinking, oh, this is really sad. I'll never be able to really pursue my passion for writing and fiction as fervently as I'm in this world. But I somehow couldn't let go of it. So I was always reading and taking every literature and writing class that I could fit into my schedule as an engineering student and even in graduate school. And, you know, I can't say that it ever feels that I'm in some sort of perfect balance. But as they oscillate back and forth with focus on either one, it seems to keep me happy. But you're right, there's sort of a dearth of people who seem to be pursuing both of these things, at least publicly. Maybe we're not acknowledging it.
your closet pursuers.
Exactly.
Do you find that writing informs the engineering and the teaching? I think that that sort of empathy would bring a lot to the teaching career, too.
I think very much. I'm not sure that it informs my the sort of research I would do in a lab or when I'm working on computer programs for my research, but certainly when I have to go tell the story of my research in a paper or a presentation and absolutely in the classroom working with students, I'm always thinking in terms of what's the story, what's the main idea, what do I want them to remember about this rather than just sort of a fire hose of equations. what might stay with them, and why might they care? And, you know, all good educators do this, I think. But I think that being a novelist and being someone who loves to read has made me more inclined to include perhaps more history and more social context for engineering material than I might otherwise have done. And I certainly make my students write a lot, which they're always a bit famished by in an engineering class. And I'm always asking them to sort of answer short answer questions, or even in some cases write articles or essays or letters to the editor informed by their technical knowledge. And they're just annoyed with me when grammar counts on those things.
That's so funny. I'm sure their response is, this is why I went into this major, was so I didn't have to do this.
many of them do say that, although I have the great good fortune to teach engineering at a liberal arts college. And so there are a remarkable number of students who are kind of like I was, thinking, gosh, did I really have to divide myself or forget about reading and stories or music or the greater liberal education that's available to me? And at least at the school where I teach, you don't.
Right.
We have a lot of engineers double majoring and pursuing all kinds of things in addition to their engineering.
So great. So great. So let's dive into the novel. I'm going to let you kind of take us into this world. The place you're supposed to laugh is the book. And, kind of set up the stage for us so we can dive in to talk about it.
Oh, thanks. So The Place You're Supposed to Laugh is set in 2002, Silicon Valley, which is a moment. I think Silicon Valley has been a surreal place for a long time, but it's a particularly surreal moment because of the dot-com explosion that has just happened and then been followed very dramatically by an implosion. So we called that the bubble bursting at the time. And so what had seemed to be this great new industry that had endless momentum and was like a perpetual motion machine, just kept generating money from just fantastic but sometimes half-baked ideas, became companies that had foosball tables and work was fun and you pulled all-nighters to do the startup energy, and then the gas got left out of the balloon really quickly. And in that context, I have a whole lot of characters in the book who are sort of unsettled, unsure of themselves, wondering, last week I was a millionaire, now I'm not anymore. Who am I really? And at the center of that is a family with their own identity issues, because they're white parents who adopted a black child at birth, and that young man is now 14. And through his eyes, there's a whole lot of adults around him who are unsettled and unsure of themselves just at the moment when he's having his own 14-year-old identity crisis and trying to figure out who he is.
Right.
So it's really about that family and that sort of extended neighborhood in that context.
It's so funny now how quaint that time period seems. And, you know, I mean, in parts of my mind, I'm like, that was yesterday. And in other parts of my mind, I'm like, that's so quaint.
It's true. I mean, 2002, it doesn't sound like a long time ago, at least not to me. I guess I'm aging myself, dating myself right. by saying that. But like, the characters don't have smartphones, and there's just this whole way of living now. You know, the notion, for example, that in the novel we have a rather blue-collar family living right next door to a mogul. Like, I don't think that's possible in Palo Alto anymore.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's so funny.
It's true.
So talk about the point of entry of the novel for you. And, you know, what propelled your interest in this novel? And, you know, was it a character? Was it this idea? Was it this place and time? Sort of what took you into it?
I'm definitely a writer who starts from character and is thinking about particular people. But, of course, they're in a particular context. And then it's sort of, well, what if this happened to them? How would they respond? That kind of gets me to start writing something that might have structure. I could spend a really long time just sketching their characters and having some sort of a plotless morass if I didn't eventually push on them a little bit. So I did start with a plotless morass of just character sketches of all these people. And I really started with two people who are sort of tech adjacent in the book. So they are father of Chad Loudermilk, the main character, and he is his name's Ray, and he's an advertising person who has been asked to promote these dot-coms, and now their industry seems to have fizzled, and so he's sort of wondering, boy, I sort of made my career on that, and I don't really understand that industry, but now it's gone. Who am I? What am I supposed to do next? And he pretty much resents the heck out of his next-door neighbor who started his own dot-com and it still seems to be doing okay. And the other person who I started with was the tech mogul's wife, who helped him start the business and then has sort of been edged out and has become a woman of leisure and is very restless. He sort of teases her as and calls her that she's suffering from terminal ennui. And I started with those two people and just in that context of this particular place and this particular moment, and then sort of moved outward and saw who else was in their web.
Interesting. So there's at least four points. There's a lot of points of view. Four, at least.
Fewer
right?
than there used to be. but yes, right now there are four.
So let's unpack some of that, because at the center of this, as you mentioned, is Chad, who is a 14-year-old black young man. And I'd love to sort of unpack what that was like for you, kind of taking that fictive leap of gender, race, age to get this kid who felt to me so very right. And, you know, if that presented challenges to you, because I talk to a lot of writers who say the more different from you, from my character, from, I'm saying this so wrong, the more different, the easier it is. And I was wondering if that was your experience or just kind of unpack that character for us a little.
Oh, that's interesting. I've enjoyed listening to you talk to authors. I'm going to have to go back and find the people who said they were comfortable when they're writing across difference. I was, as I said, I'm a bit slow in figuring out what the book's really about because I thought I was just making character sketches. And it took me a long time to figure out that Chad was really the center of it. And I think one of the reasons I resisted that was how different he is from me. And it was one thing to write about him through other people's perspectives, and it was another thing entirely to leap into this perspective and write across gender and race. And of course, you know, fiction writing is fundamentally, if you're always writing about yourself, you're not writing fiction, really, unless you can sell it as a certain Swedish author prone to autobiographical reverie. But I think you must write across difference and write about people who aren't you. That's fundamentally what we're about, is finding that empathy and understanding, writing not just about what we already know, but what we're curious about so that we can understand. And if there's anything we need more of in our country right now, it's empathy. It's trying to understand those differences. Mm-hmm. So I certainly was nervous and anxious about writing across the differences between me and Chad. I didn't want to get it wrong. I wanted to be respectful and responsible. I didn't want his race to be the only thing he had to offer as a character. I didn't want that to be his primary thing.
Yeah.
I wanted him to be a fully formed person. So I think I started with him writing about the things I did relate to the most closely, that 14-year-old sense of not being quite sure of yourself, not knowing who your people are, feeling like some of your people are, you know, betraying you or stepping out of the picture, and not knowing quite where to sit in the cafeteria. Boy, I have, like, muscle memory for what that feels like, right? So I can certainly start from that and then start thinking about the other ways that Chad is ill-prepared for the way the world's responding to him. I think about people I know who are adopted or have adopted children, people who are more, you know, who are different races than I am, people who are mixed race, whose issues are kind of maybe some half rhyme with what Chad is going through. And I, you know, use my listening and my empathy and my reading and research skills and tried to get him right without having him feel like a specimen. But feel like a person. So it's nice to hear you say that he felt real and true to you. I just love him, and it was the hardest thing as a novelist to hurt him,
yeah,
and have anything ever happen to him that wasn't right, because I felt he deserved goodness and joy.
Yes, yes. I've been talking to a couple of writers over the last, I'm trying to remember when this started, I think maybe 3 years ago, of people, publishers being sensitive to cultural, I mean, I guess they're calling it cultural appropriation, but some mm-hmm. of my novelists having a hard time getting things published, and I was wondering if that caused any issues for your publishers, if you ever got that comment.
I didn't get it from publishers or agents. It has appeared in a couple of reviews, and I think not in a negative way, but in a, let's just point out, the
yeah.
main character is African-American and the author's white. And I thought, well, that's interesting that we're pointing that out. You know, there's other characters who are men and the author's a woman. Should we point
right.
that out too?
Right.
But I think that it's not wrong for us to be super sensitive to issues of appropriation, whose story is this and who gets to tell which stories. That's been an issue, right? The canon is way too white and way too male. And
right.
so if there's any, the sort of core of my anxiety was about getting it wrong or displacing somebody who could tell this story better than me. And so my job was to tell the story as well as I possibly could, but also to make sure that, I think Rebecca Mackay wrote something beautiful about the sort of line between appropriation and allyship,
hmm.
Right? So there's power in lending your voice or telling stories that haven't been told, and having a diverse cast of characters, no one author can be a diverse cast of characters, so you're always going to be writing across difference if you're really telling that kind of multicultural story. And I have a multicultural family in the middle of a very multicultural geography, so it would be wrong not to try to represent it as fully as possible.
I love that you said that. I just I was really pushing against this notion of pushing writers back into certain boxes of what they're allowed to write about. I just think there's a huge danger in that. And anyway, I love what you said, so I'm glad we got to talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about some of the biggest challenges that may have arisen in writing this, and kind of things you didn't see coming and overcoming them. Were there sticking points in this book that got to you, and how did you get through them? How did you push through?
Oh, gosh. So I guess my biggest stumbling block was myself and my stubbornness and my reluctance to figure out that it was a story about Chad, and my writing process, which had been to write these sort of character sketches, I'm not an outliner, so figuring out what the actual plot, the main story was, took a lot more writing and then just sort of hacking away at the stuff that really didn't fit. Mm-hmm. And so there are just subplots and point of view characters and things that just had to end up on the cutting room floor. But I didn't know initially that they were going to end up there. I had to write them to figure that out. So I guess that method, the fact that I'm that kind of writer, was one of my biggest obstacles.
I'm sorry. Let me stop you there and let's unpack mm-hmm. that a little bit so that we know kind of what this looks like. So did you sit down and kind of write a draft fully all the way through and then realize, oh my God, this is what the book is really about and I didn't realize that, and then start back on page one? Or kind of what in that process does that look like?
So again, I have a lesson in how not to write a novel, at least how not to write a novel efficiently, because it took me multiple drafts to get there. And I
okay.
probably, my second and third drafts were really just polishing stuff that ultimately I was going to cut. And that just made it harder to cut because I really polished it line by line. It was like really good, smooth prose, but it didn't belong in this story. Mm. It was either extraneous or it was the wrong kind of story. I had a whole draft where I thought there really needed to be lots of action. So there was a car crash and there was this huge all characters got into the same room. They had a showdown in the middle of an IKEA. And I loved that, and I worked on it until you couldn't have found a word that didn't fit. But the problem was the whole scene didn't fit. Again, it took me a lot of drafts to get there.
Interesting. My guest this morning is Jen Stroud Rossman, the book, The Place You're Supposed to Laugh. I know from knowing you that this is not that, you know, we keep talking debut novel, and I know there are other novels in your drawer that are wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Wonderful. How many other novels are there in your drawer?
Whether they're wonderful is subject for debate, but they're in the drawer for sure. There are three and a half others. One at least I was wise enough to know I didn't need to go all the way to the end with, but definitely I wrote three others before I wrote this one.
And wow. So talk about, I don't know if the word is abandoning a project, because maybe they're never abandoned or not pursued, but... So the half novel, let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know it's just not going to work out.
Yeah, that particular one, I rewrote it as a short story. And I think I probably just misunderstood the scale of it when I started writing it. I think it's a pretty tight short story, but it didn't work. It wasn't as alive as a novel.
Gotcha.
All of them, I think, were part of, you know, the sort of apprenticeship process. And maybe this is, I can bring you back to the whole engineering writer duality, or maybe synergy, which is that in engineering we prototype stuff and we refine it, and when we ultimately get to the sort of final design of something, we may have made a dozen prototypes that we tested, we got some feedback on, and then we cast aside, and they're part of getting to this more final product that hopefully is the one that you might engage with the marketplace or the people you are trying to serve. And that sort of cycle of continuous improvement, well, you know, I had to write a couple of books to figure out how to write this book, I guess. And and while certainly I lament some of the time I spent on them, I think that doing that process is part of how I got to be able to write the book that I was able to get published. And did pursue publishing.
The thing that I'm, one of the many things that I'm so impressed by your work is your ability to manage the short story. I got to know you as a short story writer originally. And then when you hear somebody's tackling a novel, you're like, well, they're such an essentially wonderful short story writer. How's the novel going to go? And then I've read your novel and I'm like, oh my God, she's a wonderful novelist. Is there a form?
Oh, keep talking, Marie.
Is there a form you're more comfortable with, or is there, because for me, the making the leap to the novel is just, it's such an expansive canvas and it feels so overwhelming and I get lost in the woods and but you feel very comfortable in both forms, and I don't know if that is me projecting that onto you or if that's how you feel.
Well, I mean, I love both novels and short stories, and so I want to write my own, and I think, I've miscalibrated a couple of times. I have a couple of whole novels that I worked on that really were short stories and became short stories, and then I have short stories that actually were triggers for ideas that became novels. So a chapter of this novel, for example, was published separately as a short story, and it stood alone. But I think, for me, I'm a working mom who also writes novels, and so sometimes a short story is just all I can hold in my head, and I can trick myself into working on a novel by just saying, "Oh, it's just stories," you know. This, I'll just write, you know, a story, and it's really a chapter, but I'm maybe fooling myself.
Do you?
But I think.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was, you know, what I was going to say is that you're a fantastic short story writer yourself, and your story, How to Win at Losing in the Right Launch, is fantastic.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Speaking of this, you know, mothering, working, noveling, I like that I've turned noveling now into a verb. I feel like it is
absolutely.
It is a verb. Yeah, it's a very active verb. Talk
it's an
about
emotional verb.
It's a very emotional verb. It is. Talk about finding the time for all of this, because I so many writers say, "Oh, I don't," you know, "you don't have the time for exercise or writing are the two things people don't have the time for." And I think maybe if you're busier, you do have the time. But talk about shoehorning all of these things in together.
Shoehorning is a perfect word. That's perfect, because too many people say something like balance or find time, and I'm like, that's not what it is. It's just like, oh, here's 10 minutes. What can go in there? And maybe it's the laundry, or maybe it's sketching an idea or just scribbling something down that you might return to later when you have a little more time. But absolutely, I'm the kind of person who always has a notebook with me, is always ready to get that idea down with the spare moment and hope that I can return to it later. And it's not always, you know, I'm not a write-every-day kind of person. There have been moments in my life when I was on tenure track and had small children that I just wasn't writing as much. And then other moments where I could sort of seize the reins a little more and do something like a really concentrated, intensive workshop, like the one where we met at One Story or Tin House or Squaw Valley, that let me build community and build my skills up and feel like a writer for a week. And that could energize me and motivate me to keep shoehorning the writing in, even when it was a challenge to do so.
Right, right. You have so many letters after your name, but MFA is not one, not three of them.
That is true.
And you've talked about doing these summer workshops, Tin House and One Story and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel at any disadvantage with other writers for not having the MFA, or do you feel like these summer programs give sort of the perfect balance, or what are your feelings about that?
So, yeah, I mean, I think through the workshops and the reading I've done, I think I've tried to cobble together a sort of DIY MFA, but I didn't have that what you can get if you have a residential MFA where you're just 2 years of just the universe is telling you you're here to write. This is what you're supposed to do for 2 years. I've never had that, and I think envy it a bit and covet it, but I also know that the way I've done the writing I have done is in these spaces and shoehorned moments. I don't know if I'd be able to function if it was the only thing I was supposed to do. Like, I think I'd miss the classroom, I'd miss my equations. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful kind of permission, I think, granting that I had to figure out how to grant myself. You know, take the time, make the time. This is a valuable thing to do for yourself. I think getting the MFA does that in a sort of formal way, and it sort of certifies you. It says to the world, hey, she's doing this, and now she's going to be certified, real writer, seal of approval. So I guess I wouldn't mind having that.
Me too, but, I suppose.
But, I mean, I could print those up, and we could have stickers that say certified writer, and we could just stick them on when we sat down to do our work.
I like that.
I
like that. So you are coming. I want to get this out for our Southern California audience, and I'm so excited. You're coming next week to the last bookstore in L.A.
Oh, I'm thrilled, yes.
Me too. So next Thursday, January 17th at 7, yes?
It's at 7:30.
7:30. Okay, well, I'm getting there at 7. So
anyway. Fantastic. I'll be there.
And tell us also where we can find you online so we can stalk you and see you. You're going to be in the Bay Area as well.
I'm going to be in the Bay Area, so it's a Californian swing, or West Coast swing, as I think Boys to Men would have said. January 14th, Monday night, I'm in San Francisco at Books Inc. Marina, and then the following day at 4 p.m. I'm doing a talk at the Campbell Library in the South Bay, and then I'll come down and be Thursday night at the Last Bookstore, which is a remarkable spot. It has a lot of secret passages in that bookstore, so I'm hoping for some sort of secret entrance, and I'm very much hoping not to get trapped a la Spinal Tap on the way to the podium. But that would certainly be memorable, and that would be fine. People can find me on Twitter at Jen_Rossman, or they can go to my website, jenstroudrossman.com, and they just need to remember that Rossman and Jen both have two N's in them.
That's right.
And that should guide them.
When all else fails, double the letter is the answer.
Absolutely. Two N's.
And any last-minute words of writing wisdom and advice, things that you've gotten from these writing workshops or anything else, whatever sustained you through the novels?
Oh, what a fantastic question. I suppose I would just quote my sort of high school English teacher, and writing is rewriting, and that sort of iterative revising, looking at it as fresh as possible, it really does help, although it isn't a recipe for speed.
Right.
Learn to love it.
Learn to love it. Nope, that's exactly right. The revision process is where it all happens. Where it all happens, man. Jen, this was a huge treat. Thank you so, so much. I can't wait to see you next week. And we'll
likewise.
Pick up our conversation there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing from June.
That was Jen Stroud-Rossman, the book, The Place You're Supposed to Laugh, out and available now. We're going to take a very short break. I will be right back here with you. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus on Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. Next week's speaker series event has sold out, but there are still a few tickets available for February, when Pam Houston will be here, February 5th, I think that is. So if you're interested in that, I recommend signing up early and often. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. June Casagrande's syndicated grammar column, A Word Please, runs in newspapers in 5 states. She's the author of 4 grammar books, including It Was the Best of Sentences, It Was the Worst of Sentences, period, and the Best Punctuation Book, period. She is the face and voice of Grammar Underground weekly podcast. She works as a freelance copy editor for the advertising department of the LA Times and for several local and national magazines. Her latest, The Joy of Syntax, A Simple Guide to All the Grammar You Know You Should Know, was published by Penguin Random House last summer. I missed having her on then. I should have, but I thought now is a perfect time with your New Year's resolutions, when I know you're all sending out your manuscripts, you're sending out your books, your query letters, a good time for a refresher in grammar. And I can't tell you, for as much as I love grammar, how much I learned in reading this book. So we are going to bring her on. June, hi.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Who knew there could be this much grammar to know? And I learned so much from reading so much about you.
I'm glad to hear it. The linguistics department at every university in the college knows all this stuff about grammar, and somehow it never spills over into the English department. I can't figure out why.
Right, right. I know. Well, you know, I got this. And then I was reading, I was like, really? Really? It's good to have these refresher classes. So I introduced you, but I'd love for you to just in a few minutes expand kind of on your own history with grammar, how you got interested, your path into the profession, and all of that, because your passion is infectious, I would say.
Thank you. I first encountered the concept of grammar in a college French class. And it was kind of exciting to me to learn that there are mechanics associated with how we talk. Just the concept of verb conjugations was kind of exciting to me, because no one really sits you down when you're a kid, you know, when you're a native English speaker in the third grade and says, okay, we say sit, today I sit, yesterday I sat, in the past I have sat. No one teaches you those mechanics because you picked them up on your own. And so beginning to learn those in college was kind of exciting and interesting for me. And then I wanted to become a writer, and it sort of took me toward editing a little, and I started to pick up things. And I got some bad information about grammar and usage to begin with. I didn't understand that if someone says, don't split an infinitive, that they necessarily have their facts straight.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, right. That's not true. So I started off kind of excited about, I discovered these rules, and then I had to relearn actually a lot of these aren't rules, and it was sort of a challenge for me to continue to improve those skills and apply them to help writers write better, which is what I do in a lot of my editing work, is I refine sentences and refine messaging and clean things up in a way that serves the message. And to me, that's what language is about, is it's a vehicle for what a writer wants to say.
I love that you said that, because I think one of the fun things interesting things about grammar is that in fiction, you know the rules, and then, or it's important to know the foundational rules, and then you can play around with breaking them. And the playing around with breaking them, I think, is really fun. But if you're not doing it intentionally and you don't quite understand what the underlying rule is, it kind of falls apart. I think your reader can sort of tell. So this is great.
Agreed. And in fiction, a lot of writers, I think, are a little turned off by the concept of grammar because they associate it with almost a sort of Emily Post book of etiquette about writing. And when you're writing fiction, you don't need someone to tell you that your hard-boiled detective character should use the word whom. Anyone who wants to, anyone who just doesn't want to hear that is right to not want to hear that. Your hard-boiled detective character should not be saying whom, probably, if you don't think so. But real grammar is the stuff that makes your message come out better. It's the mechanics of how you say things. It's how sentences are structured, and it's not people telling you how your character should talk, how your narrator should talk, what your voice should be. It's how you can harness your own message better.
Right, right. So let's dive into The Joy of Syntax and talk a little bit about how this book differs from the books you've written previously. And now I'm hypersensitive to everything I'm saying because I'm like, that probably wasn't grammatical. But anyway, kind of take us into this book, how this book differs and what it's going to give writers that other grammar books out there do not.
My editor basically said to me, I would like to do a straight grammar book, which is something I hadn't thought of. I had come up with sort of angles in the past, like here are 101 things people say you can't do, are they right, this kind of thing. That was my book, Mortal Syntax. This one, my editor said, I would like to do a straight grammar book. I would like you to do a straight grammar book. I'm like, what do I have to say about that? And what I have to say about that is that most grammar books marketed to adult writers are handy tips. They're collections of things you should know that completely sort of gloss over the foundation of syntax, of the things you really need to understand this tool you're using, which is language. And so, as I mentioned, linguistics departments before, not spilling over into, not getting the message into English departments, I wanted to take a really hardcore academic linguistic approach to grammar and understanding language, extract the parts that are useful and practical for writers in the real world, and make that a grammar book. And that's what kind of sets this book apart, is it's not just tips, it's here's the foundation. When you're finished with this book, you will understand every part of a sentence, how it's working, and how you can change its function in a way to work better for you.
It's so funny how hard a time I have holding these things in my head. Like, I don't know why I can't remember, what a subordinate clause means from, I don't know. I mean, I always have to, there are always things that I feel like I have to find, I have to look up. And this is incredibly handy for that as well. I mean, if it's just sitting on your desk and you're like, oh, I'm a little bit confused about this, at least you can reference it again rather than reminding yourself every single, forcing yourself to remember what split infinitives and everything are each time. I don't know. There's also a very handy glossary in the back.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yes, please.
As I was waiting to talk to you today, I was thumbing through my own book just to refresh myself on the concepts and thinking, oh, I don't fully recall how this works. Oh, I don't. I did the same thing.
Thing
you just said with my own content. I'm like, wait a minute, what's a nominal clause? I don't remember. Right. And so I guess the message there is that's okay.
Okay, good.
The person telling you about them doesn't remember either.
Because I'm like, how many English classes did I take? And I cannot hold in my brain what these things are. But the other thing I love about this is there's, like I say, there's a handy glossary in the back for all of those little terms. And there's also there's an index. And then there's also just a wonderful, which I'm also embarrassed to say, there are so many words like flounder and founder that I just have screwed up my whole adult life thinking that I kind of was a word person and realizing I got a long way to go. So.
Language in general and usage in particular is so humbling in exactly that way. It was a lot more recent than I care to admit that I discovered that never mind is two words. I've always written.
I'm like, really?
It should be one of them.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
So it's, and that's kind of the great thing about the whole subject is people who want to make others feel sort of small with grammar, and these people are out there, the sticklers and the snobs and stuff, we're all vulnerable to this type of humbling experience because none of us can either know it all or remember it all. So it's okay. I mess up stuff like founder and flounder, too. I can't think of any specific examples of ones that are my personal ones, but that's just being human.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I love it. I should also mention that you have some background in comedy, that you studied with comedians. And I think some of that gets infused in your books and certainly in your blog, and just makes it more fun, you know, that grammar doesn't have to be so uptight and scary, that, you know, it's you just make it a little bit more accessible and interesting, and, you know, great. That's I don't know how much of the comedy stuff you feel like you bring to your writing, but it felt that way to me.
Thanks for saying so. I think humor belongs with the subject. It really does, because it's, if you're going to take it too seriously, it's not going to help anyone, including yourself. So, and there's nothing to do but laugh when you realize you've been making a mistake your whole life.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is June Casagrande, the book, The Joy of Syntax, A Simple Guide to All the Grammar You Know You Should Know. So let's talk about some of these common mistakes that you see even very good writers make. What should we kind of highlight on here that people should have their eye on?
It's always a good idea to just skim lists of common usage errors from time to time, because we all have our own, and it sort of varies from writer to writer and from person to person. A very common one I see is to forego. If you're going to forego something, there's no E in that. There is a forego with an E in it, but it means to go before, which is something we almost never use. If you mean to do without something, there's no E. Another word that has no E is at the end is that does have an E is adrenaline.
Oh, right.
That's something else I see misused a lot. I probably just worded that in a way that was confusing. If you're talking about someone's adrenaline levels in their blood, that has an E, but if you type it without one, spell check won't catch it because there's a brand name that doesn't have one, and I see that mistake quite a bit. Compliment with an E in the middle.
Yeah.
Versus compliment with an I in the middle. That one gets confused quite a bit. If two things go well together, or if a wine completes a meal, that's compliment with an E in the middle. And if you're telling someone their hair looks good, that's compliment with an I in the middle.
I like that you're bringing these up, because I think a lot of us are getting very dependent on Word and Word's little tool for grammar catching and spell checking catching, and they are using it in a very lazy way to figure that, you know, everything they've typed is probably fine because Word's not calling them out on it. And a good reminder that Word is not going to catch all of these things on your behalf because, you know, they're technically not typos, or, you know, they're there is a word out there. It's just not the one you're trying to use. So
there's a hashtag that sometimes gets used on Twitter. Spell check cannot save you. And editors on Twitter will sometimes use that hashtag to point out errors they themselves came across while editing. And there are some doozies. One that comes to mind had to do with, there were some kind of sexual harassment allegations against, maybe it had to do with Roy Moore in a congressional race. And the headline was sex clams instead of sex claims. Spell check will not save you.
Right.
That is a fact. It will save you sometimes, but you can't count on it. So,
do you find, now that you've worked in this field for a while, that things are getting worse for grammar enthusiasts as sort of, you know, Twitter and texting and all of that is entering our you know, day-to-day writing more and more, that people are getting lazier?
You know, people assume that these things are harmful to the language, that because I don't have to learn how to spell a certain word that I'm not bothering to learn. And I think researchers have actually determined that's not the case and that's not what's happening. And it's not even really affecting spellings much, like UR instead of YOUR as an abbreviation in texting. There's no indication that the language is moving in that particular direction. So my personal anecdotal view of it is sort of, I'm not clear on it, but I know researchers have said that it's really not affecting people's grasp of the language that much. I'm not 100% sure how and why they reached those conclusions, but
that's good.
But that's the prose answer on that.
That's great. That's great. I'd love to dive in a little bit, because this is a show so geared towards fiction writers and playing with grammar in fiction. You wrote a really wonderful piece, I don't know, it was maybe it was last year, about the syntax of literature's greatest lines. And you took so many wonderful examples like Cormac McCarthy and a couple of these other wonderful writers who really use... who break the rules to great effect. And I was wondering if we could highlight some of the ways fiction writers can break the rules to great effect. Cormac McCarthy doesn't use apostrophes in The Road, and I just thought that was so effective and something an editor ill-experienced would lose his mind over.
So effective is a really good way of putting that. I've heard a lot of discussion about it, about whether it's bad or good, right or wrong, arrogant, that kind of thing. And to me, I didn't notice. I read all of The Road without noticing there were no apostrophes in his contractions, which to me speaks volumes about the effect. And I'm a proofreader. It's my job to catch those things.
Right.
And to me it speaks volumes about the effectiveness of how that fit into his story and his message. And his whole story was, these are two people in a world where even their first name, things are so dire and desperate and the world is so coming to an end that even the characters' names don't matter. Even how they got into the post-apocalyptic world they're wandering through doesn't matter. The backstory, nothing matters except these last gasps of survival. So apostrophes don't matter. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of really impressive to me how that all worked together to make his story more, this is the end, folks. This is it. So effective is exactly the word I would use for that.
I'd like to point out one other one. I don't know if you've read Jose Saramago's Blindness, but so the premise is that, you know, this man is sitting at a stop sign and suddenly he just sees white, and it's this contagious malady that spreads throughout the society. So everybody is going blind and they only see white. And he never uses a quotation mark to set off when people are talking. And it gives the reader this feeling like, I don't know who's talking. I don't know where they are. I don't know who we are. You know, I don't. So it gives the reader sort of this impression of blindness. And I thought, oh, my God, that's such a great way to impart this emotion on a reader viscerally, because they can't kind of see what's coming at them, even as they're using their eyes to read it. Anyway, I just thought that was a brilliant.
That is cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
I'm not familiar with that work. That is very cool. And if he pulled it off, and I assume he did by how much you liked the book, that's very impressive. And it's, I've just added something to my reading list.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Just another way to use a play with punctuation or a play with grammar or a play with words, you know, to impart emotion to the reader. I don't know if you have other examples of that you'd like to call out that you love. I'm putting you on the spot.
One example I use in my book, it was the best of sentences, it was the worst of sentences, involves relative clauses. And a relative clause is when you post-modify a noun by saying which or that. So the car, which was red, which he was driving, which had been parked in the yard that long, each of those which clauses is a relative clause. And stacking too many on in a sentence can be really problematic. Just break up the sentence. You're making a mess. You're making it hard to keep track of what you're saying. But there's a passage in Neil Gaiman's American Gods where he sort of stacks these relative clauses while talking about a van, a smelly van. It's like they were driving this van, which smelled like male cat, which this, which that. And his aim was to sort of just pile on to the reader this idea of, we've got kind of a very unpleasant multi-tiered catastrophe going on here. And it was very effective. So relative clauses are another example of something you can tinker with, and that Neil Gaiman has tinkered with in a way that sort of violates conventional wisdom about writing. But if you know what you're doing, you can really use it to your effect.
Right. Or James Joyce having, you know, a one sentence, I don't know how long that last chapter was, but in Ulysses, I think it was like 900 pages. I don't know. It was all one sentence. Good job.
That sometimes it can come off like a stunt,
yeah,
as a gimmick. I can't speak to that because I actually haven't read it, I'm sorry to say.
No one has.
But if it comes off like a gimmick, there's no need to do this. Creating fiction is hard enough without trying to fancify and break rules just for the sake of breaking them. When you're focused on character and story and voice and all that stuff, these things can supplement that. But it's kind of, I would caution people not to try to get too showy with this stuff, because you've got enough on your plate already if you're trying to write a good story.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and modify my last statement. I did read Ulysses, and it's brilliant. And if you are James Joyce, go forth and do these things. take a note of caution if you're trying to imitate James Joyce, because it's very, very difficult. so good.
Don't
try this at home, kids. Exactly right. So I want to give a little shout out to your podcast and to your blog, because and on the blog there are six, I think they're like New Year's resolutions or something for grammar enthusiasts. And we're running out of time, but read the front of the dictionary, people. You said that, and then I went and did it, and I was like, I would have never done that had you not mentioned that. So very interesting. So kind of point us in the direction of your blog, where we can find you and where we can hear more.
I'm online at grammarunderground.com, and I tweet at grammarunder on Twitter, and that's about it for my online that's actually about it. No longer have my own website because I stopped paying for the domain because I stopped maintaining.
How often is the podcast on? That's still going, yeah?
I post them once a week.
Okay, yeah.
They go up every Monday with a new blog post, too. And the blog posts are often a link to a recent column I wrote. My columns appear near you in the Daily Pilot supplement to the Los Angeles Times.
Oh, right.
And they're, of course, available online. But they're in a number of little Los Angeles Times community news supplements, including the Glendale News Press and the Burbank Leader. So I'm out there. Those go up weekly.
So good. I'm going to go out on giving you a chance to talk about. I know there's a writer out there you love to hate for his grammar, who writes in translation. I heard a podcast of you talking about. His name has flown out of my brain, but he wrote The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Stieg Larsson.
Thank you. are there other examples of wonderful writers out there using grammar to great effect, or writers out there in kind of in the opposite category that we now have just mentioned?
Stieg Larsson, my problems with his writing aren't so much the grammar or the translation. It's his how he structures stories, which is a little outside of my area of expertise because I'm not a story editor. But it just seems to me that when you spend a page and a half listing items purchased at an IKEA, you've kind of forgotten you have a reader who may or may not care about every item purchased at that IKEA. to me, great writing and great use of grammar are a lot like great acting. When they're really good, most of the time you don't notice. They're supposed to be transparent. They're supposed to be vehicles for this other thing. They're supposed to get out of the way. So to write a piece on these, to write the piece I wrote about the writers who defy the rules of grammar, including Cormac McCarthy, was sort of a brain strain for me to think about writers that do that, because if I'm not paying attention to your grammar or your sentence structure, you're doing something right.
Right.
So to me, it's a bit like great acting. If you don't notice it, you've mastered it. If the reader doesn't notice it, the writer has mastered it.
Perfect. That's perfect. Perfect advice to end on. June Casagrande, that was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.